Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is the overuse of antibiotics and some of the consequences of this overuse, particularly the rise of microbial resistance to antibiotics. This particular problem has been estimated to cause about 2 million infections per year in the United States and 23,000 deaths. So it's an important issue. Talking to us about this today by telephone from Atlanta at the CDC is Dr. Michael Bell. Dr. Bell is the Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control's Division on Healthcare Quality Promotion. This division is responsible for programs in the prevention of antimicrobial resistance. He did his training at the University of Washington and at the University of Colorado and did an infectious disease fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Bell, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Well, I like to start programs with basics and kind of build into the issue. This is maybe not as simple of a problem as it might first appear. So let's start with by some definitions. What's an antibiotic, and where do these things come from?
Sure. Well, so antibiotics are chemicals that kill one thing but not another thing. So basically, they're a selectively targeted chemical that will kill a bacteria or a fungus that's causing an infection, but won't harm human cells.
And where did we get the idea to take advantage or find antibiotics?
Well, so, you know, you asked where did these things come from, and, you know, through the years, for hundreds of years actually, people observed that something was out there that seemed to kill bacteria and other microorganisms. You know, Alexander Fleming gets a lot of the credit for developing antibiotics, but in fact, all the way back to Pasteur in the late 1800s, Robert Koch, Paul Ehrlich, these are historical scientists from around 1880 who are already starting to make chemicals that would kill organisms like bacteria. In fact, it was around 1910 when we first saw the delivery of a commercial antibiotic called Salvarsan. That was an arsenic-based chemical that was used to treat syphilis. And that started the entire chain of pharmaceutical production of antibiotics.
And it was an observation, for example, that many may have heard of, that a petri dish with some bacteria growing on it, where the bacteria was suppressed by what turned out to be a fungus, Penicillium, and so it appears, if you think about that these kinds of chemicals have been present in nature for a long time.
Exactly. You know, we see this not only in the bacterial world. We see plants that wage chemical warfare on other plants. You know, if you look at the base of a eucalyptus tree, you can see that some of the chemicals released by the leaves from that tree inhibit the growth of other plants. And in a much smaller scale, but equally cutthroat, the microbial world is all about gaining a little bit of an advantage, having more of a foothold than the next bacterium or the next fungus. And many of these organisms have gradually evolved the ability to release chemicals that inhibit their competitors.
Anytime we talk about this, I like to bring up the fact that increasingly we've become aware that we do get a lot of our antibiotics from nature, you know, traditionally from plants, but I've read recently that even the marine environment is now being really looked at very carefully. And the reason for bringing it up is that as we change nature, as we get rid of the flora, particularly in the Amazon area, we're at the same time potentially getting rid of lots of medications that might be effective. And is that reasonable to mention, or am I overdoing that particular idea?
Well, no, I think, you know, any time we lose an ecosystem, you know, that's irreplaceable treasure. The parallel discussion, though, is how easy is it to go out there and find the next new chemical?
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, a small number of people who are still out there doing it, but it's been an economic challenge for many pharmaceutical companies. Just when you think about the reality of, you know, take the hypothetical jungle example, if you're sending a team out there to look for these chemicals, first of all, there's no guarantee you're going to find anything useful. If you find something that seems to kill other bacteria or kill bacteria in general, there's no guarantee that it's going to be safe for humans or other animals, and that there won't be some side effects. And so the years and literally millions of dollars that it takes to, you know, find something in the jungle, test it, prove that it works and is safe, and then bring it to market is huge. And in comparison with a lot of other medications, like blood pressure medication or cholesterol medication, you know, antibiotics are things that we use for a brief time, just a couple of weeks at most, in most instances, to cure an infection, and then we don't need it. As opposed to some of these other medications that, you know, large numbers of people take for years and years and years, if you look at the business model there, it's a no-brainer for the pharmaceutical companies to focus their energies on those other medications instead of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons that the Food and Drug Administration and other parts of the government have been trying to work with the pharmaceutical industry to make it a little bit easier to invest in bringing another antibiotic to the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a sub-theme there that may not have been picked up, or I want to emphasize, is that not just antibiotics, but many types of medications used in humans and veterinary medicine have been found by exploring nature. And so it's not just antibiotics that we're getting our ideas about healthcare for humans from nature. All right. So you've mentioned a little bit about the history of antibiotics. Can you maybe bring us up a little bit more up to date about what we're doing with antibiotics since Fleming and the late 1800s and so forth started beginning to understand there are chemicals out there that we can use to help fight infections?
Yep. So through the last century, there's been a steady stream of antibiotics being developed. First, it was the arsenic compound that I mentioned, then it was sulfa drugs, and then finally the penicillins came on board, and on and on and on. And what I can tell you is that there's a very, very clear pattern here. Every time we find something that kills bacteria and is safe for humans, it's really just a matter of a handful of years, a dozen at the most, before we start seeing bacteria that started out being killed by these chemicals. But soon enough, we see that a subgroup of those bacteria start to be able to resist the effect of the antibiotic. What that's showing us is that, you know, when you have something like a bacterium that is reproducing every 20 minutes, doubling, on average, the amount of reproduction and the possibility of small mutations to crop up is tremendous. And a few of these mutations, over the course of time, will confer that lucky trait that lets that particular family of bacteria stand up to a chemical like an antibiotic. And so what you see is in a great big pool of bacteria, ordinarily you might not have any bacteria that are able to either make a special protein or create a special pump that gets rid of antibiotics. Those may not exist in what's called the wild type or the normal bacteria. But then when you start challenging that population of bacteria with an antibiotic, any mutation that gives the ability to survive that challenge is going to be passed on to the survivors. And very quickly, you end up with a much larger population, all of which are resistant, and that basically makes the antibiotic not useful anymore. We've seen that pattern repeated with every type of antibiotic that's been produced since day one, and it's continuing to gallop along. The good news is if you take away the antibiotic and don't use it for a while, most of those bacteria will go back to the wild type. It costs energy to be producing that special protein or that modified pump, and that energy slows down the reproduction, that loss of energy. And so bacteria, when they don't need to produce these things, they will be much more successful in multiplying, well, not much more, but a little bit more successful in multiplying, if they don't have to spend that energy on the pump, and instead can just keep doubling a little bit faster. And that gives the whole population a tendency to move back to that original wild type. That doesn't mean that it can't swing back very quickly if the antibiotic comes back, but it is good news because it means that if we don't overuse an antibiotic, we can actually move the population of bacteria a little bit closer to that original susceptible type of bacteria.
Very, very interesting. So this is, it makes me think about this is just evolution happening very, very fastly, very fast. We're having this natural selection going on, and in certain populations, depending on the environment, if there's that antibiotic, then it becomes a positive adaption for that organism to survive. But after, if you stop using it, it now is really a negative adaption. It's not so beneficial, and it's more likely to disappear over time.
Exactly. And what we're trying to do as doctors is find that happy medium where we're using the antibiotics when we absolutely have to, but holding back when we don't have to use them so that we maintain the bacteria in a state of susceptibility so that we can continue to get the benefit of that antibiotic.
I failed to mention at the beginning of the program to the listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and my guest today is Dr. Michael Bell of the CDC. And we're talking about overuse of antibiotics and the consequences, particularly resistance to different microbes to antibiotics. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, here's a couple of ways to get in touch with us over the next 45 minutes or so. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and also an email address, line1, and you have to spell that out, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. How are antibiotics used? If this is becoming a problem, then it would seem like it'd behoove us to understand where antibiotics are being used if we're going to address the overuse.
Great question. So antibiotics are used in the way we commonly think about it. When somebody comes in with an infection and you want to cure the infection, you pick an antibiotic that you think is likely to work. And then in many cases, you'll also test the bacteria with a culture. You'll grow it up and then challenge that bacteria in the laboratory against several different antibiotics so that you know what it's resistant to and what it's not. And then you can go back and adjust your antibiotic choice if you need to. That's the sort of classic way that we tend to think about antibiotics being used. But there are other ways. If you think about having an operation, before your surgery, about an hour before, if you're having your appendix removed, for example, you'll get a big dose of antibiotics so that just in case bacteria are released from the intestine during the surgery, it's not going to lead to a big active infection, but will get stemmed by the antibiotic in your system. So that kind of prophylactic antibiotic use is very common, and it's an important part of safe surgery. Another way we use antibiotics is empirically. So we don't know for sure what's causing an infection, but we think there might be one there, and we take a shot at treating it just in case it's helpful. A great example of that is if somebody has cancer therapy that wipes out their immune system temporarily. During that time, a patient is very, very susceptible to a bad infection. And rather than take any chances, at the first sign of a fever, when you have no immune cells circulating, the doctor will prescribe a very powerful antibiotic so that there's no chance of that developing into a life-threatening infection. So that kind of empiric therapy is also very common and quite important. In addition to that, there is the large chunk of unnecessary antibiotic use, unfortunately, that we see happen. When somebody comes in with, a cough and a cold and is given an antibiotic, that's a mistake. We know very well that these are viruses that tend to cause colds and runny noses and coughs, and the antibiotic doesn't help at all. It doesn't do a thing to the virus, but it can actually harm the patient. We can talk a little more about that in a minute. But that inappropriate use, that unnecessary antibiotic use, is the low-hanging fruit in human medical care that we're trying to get rid of.
What? Before, and there's plenty to talk about with problems and understanding the appropriate use of antibiotics in humans, but what about outside of human health care? Where else and to what degree to the total burden of antibiotics are other industries using antibiotics?
Well, so antibiotics get used in a bewildering number of places outside of human healthcare. There is veterinary medical use, which is the same as human medical use in that you're trying to treat or prevent an infection in certain very appropriate circumstances. There is just as likely as in human medicine to be inappropriate use in veterinary care as well. But then there's also the antibiotics that are used in animal husbandry that aren't to treat an infection, but are instead used to, for example, grow chickens faster. There's certainly an economic benefit to having chickens grow more quickly. You can bring them to market sooner and at less cost, which is passed on then to the consumer. You and I get to enjoy cheaper chickens, and that's a nice thing. But what we've seen in the past is if antibiotics that are closely related to human medical antibiotics are used freely in food production, that can actually influence the prevalence of resistant bacteria in the environment and ultimately back in the healthcare setting for humans. The example that I'm talking about is a drug that was discontinued in this country a few years back, but it was used to promote growth in chickens, and we found that it was a very close cousin to vancomycin, which is a very important human antibiotic, and we saw related to that this proliferation of resistance to vancomycin among Enterococcus. Enterococcus can cause some bad infections in human beings, especially if you're severely ill for other reasons. And Enterococcus, interestingly enough, also has a role of promoting growth in livestock. It turns out that that's one of the bacteria, a probiotic, that you can also give a chicken to make it grow faster. That combination of using both the antibiotic and a probiotic bacterium is a model that you can easily see leading to the creation of resistant Enterococcus. Enterococcus, just by the way, is also a bacteria that's used to make cheese. I mean, it's been part of human food production for a very long time. And so the fact that then it's in human beings' digestive tracts and carries that resistant trait from, you know, wherever it was exposed to the vancomycin into the human being, that shouldn't be a surprise at all. It's all very much connected, and it's never truer than with things like this, that we are what we eat.
I was looking at a more recent or fairly recent New England Journal of Medicine, kind of almost like an editorial or comment that was in late December of last year, and was a little surprised to see that by weight, that about 80% of all antibiotics that are made are used in agriculture or aquaculture, including, as you said, feeding chickens and pigs and salmon even. But even in added to paint that inhibits barnacles on boats. So there's a lot of it being used outside of the traditional medical use.
Absolutely.
Another question that comes up or a comment that I've heard, and I do not know whether this is true or not, that in many countries, antibiotics are available without prescription. And so it begs the question, what percentage of of total antibiotic use in humans is outside of the United States, and do we have any epidemiology to suggest that that may be a bigger drive than what is going on in our country?
Well, we know for certain that places that don't have any controls over antibiotic purchases have a huge problem with resistance, and this ranges not only for bacteria like staph bacteria or gut bacteria, but also for things like tuberculosis. We have seen the generation of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, or CRE. Enterobacteriaceae is the family of bacteria that includes common germs like E. coli or Klebsiella. These are normal, important bacteria that live in our guts. If we don't have them, we become very ill, actually, because other bacteria will sort of move into the gap and cause lots of problems. Well, we've seen the resistance to the class of drug called carbapenem, a very important sort of high-level antibiotic, generated in places in South Asia and South America where there has been no requirement for a prescription, and these are sold freely. Now, there's a flip side to the story, which is that in some of these places, if you required a prescription from a physician or a nurse, that would be a problem because there are no physicians or nurses. Hmm. And so, as with so many things we deal with, you know, there needs to be a balance where people are able to get life-saving medications when they need them, but not so freely that they become ineffective.
Okay. Let me just take a second to mention again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and my guest is Dr. Michael Bell. He is the Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control's Division on Healthcare Quality Promotion, and we're discussing the consequences of overuse of antibiotics. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433, and our toll-free number, line 1, at alaskapublic.org. You had begun to imply earlier that not only do antibiotics not treat viruses, and we may at some point here want to talk about the differences briefly between bacteria and viruses, but they also bring along a host of potential problems when used inappropriately.
That's exactly right. So it is a double-edged sword, and we want to use antibiotics when truly necessary. But if we cause an avoidable problem when we didn't even need the drug in the first place, that can be quite a tragedy. One of the most problematic side effects of antibiotics is a secondary infection caused by a germ called Clostridium difficile. Or C. diff. Clostridium difficile is a bacterium that normally, even if you carry it around in your gut, it stays pretty dormant. But it is one of those organisms that if you take away the normal population of gut bacteria, it will start multiplying, and certain strains of that bacteria produce a toxin. This is the toxin that causes the antibiotic-associated diarrhea that many people have probably heard about through the years. The difference, though, is that the currently circulating type of C. diff carries a much more potent toxin. So instead of just diarrhea for a couple, 3 weeks after after antibiotic exposure, we're talking about a colitis, an inflamed colon, that is so severe that in many cases people have to have their colons removed surgically. It's a tremendously dangerous infection in that sense. And if you think about, you know, the example that can be quite common of an elderly person who slips and falls and perhaps breaks a hip, you know, that person going into the hospital for her hip replacement might do very well in surgery, but what if she acquires a urinary tract infection as she's recovering, receives an antibiotic, and then 5 days later is so ill from the colon infection that she needs to have her colon removed? That makes the difference between sailing through a great operation, having a functional hip, and going back home, versus being at risk of dying in the hospital, or being stuck in a rehab facility for a very long time. So that kind of unintended consequence of antibiotic use is something that we are very sensitive to, and one of the reasons that we push so strongly to make sure that antibiotics are used just when they're needed.
We're beginning to get a couple of calls, and I want to take a second and take our break that we typically do, Dr. Bell. But beforehand, another question that just kind of came to my mind is, you know, what's happened, at least in pediatric health care, and since I follow the public health issues quite a bit, is that that since about the 1980s, infections have been replaced by unintentional injury as the leading cause of death, I think, in morbidity, ER visits, and so forth, between 1 year and 44 years of age. And if that's true, which I'm pretty sure it is, then the question becomes, are we using less antibiotics per capita as a consequence of that improved health care, which, again, I want to point out, is probably somewhat due to immunization, since as a pediatrician, I've seen meningitis almost virtually disappear in a private practice. So is there evidence that we are already on a slide down per use because of changing health care or health issues, or is that not true?
I wish it were true, but we don't see any evidence that very handy solution is in fact true. I'll say this. I started by describing the classic infection that you go in to have treatment for. But it's important to remember that antibiotics, when you mentioned that people aren't dying as much of infections now, antibiotics let us do a lot of other medicine that isn't related directly to an infection. For example, if I'm hit by a car and, my belly is wide open on the street, talented surgeons can put me back together. But with all of that, germy dirt and gut bacteria in my abdomen, I'm not going to survive even if the surgery goes really well if I don't have an antibiotic to clean up the infection. Likewise, there can be amazing improvements in chemotherapy and cancer care, but if during the time that you have no immune system, you can't be treated for an infection, then a lot of cancer care becomes impossible. Same thing with burn units, where if I have a terrible burn, the likelihood of that becoming infected is pretty darn high, and if I can't be treated with an antibiotic, I'm likely to be doomed. So I think it's important to think about all of the sort of additional types of medical care that we take for granted that are made possible because we have effective antibiotics.
Yeah, so we've solved a lot of problems. We've improved some healthcare in other areas, which have driven a little bit more antibiotic use, and a lot of that appropriate, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okie dokie. All right, let's take our break. Let me ask the three callers I know that are on the line to hang on for just about a minute or so, and we'll come back and take their questions. And remind everybody also that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll rejoin my guest, Dr. Michael Bell, and continue our discussion on antibiotic overuse. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today, joining us by telephone from the CDC, is Dr. Michael Bell, and we're discussing antibiotic overuse and the consequences, and particularly the development of antibiotic resistance by other different microorganisms. You can mail your questions over the next 30 minutes or so to line1 at alaskapublic.org, or you can call us locally at 550-8433. Please remember, as you've heard before, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, so we won't be able to answer your questions. And also remember, at any time, you can go to alaskapublic.org and get the Line 1 link and listen to our previous programs on an archived format. Let's take our first caller. Carrie, you're on Line 1. What can we do for you?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to ask Dr. Bell what recommendations he would have for me, because I have an immune deficiency. And when I get sick with respiratory things, I need antibiotics. How can I get the right one in a timely fashion? Usually it's a problem getting practitioners to prescribe it.
You know, I think there you are somebody who, it sounds like, very appropriately needs access to antibiotics. There are different types of immune deficiencies that put people at risk for different types of infections. So that's one piece of information. But from what you're saying, my hunch is that the most important thing is the relationship with your care provider. In a sense, you almost will need to train your healthcare provider to understand your personal needs. So building that relationship is going to be key. And it's also helpful in the sense that understanding what infections you've had through the years and what organisms have grown from cultures and so on will help inform that person's care that they provide you. So, yeah, frankly, even though it would be nice if there was an easy answer here, I think that the key is going to be to build a relationship with a practitioner that you trust who understands your specific needs.
Thank you.
Yeah, Carrie, another thought that comes to my mind is if you have a primary care physician and we know your immune deficiency exactly, because it does depend on the immune deficiency, what particular infections you might be susceptible and therefore what treatments might be effective, even just having a letter or something from him or her describing that may help you break down the barriers in emergency rooms and other situations.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Jenny, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Good afternoon, Dr. Woodard and Dr. Bell. Thank you so much for taking my call. Earlier, you spoke about using antibiotics to help take chickens to market weight and reducing the cost of that. And I found that very interesting, and I've heard about that before. My husband and I raise 4 or 5 chickens a year just for personal use, and we don't get anything special. We buy Cornish cross chicks, and we feed them food that's produced locally, and they have the run of the backyard. And our birds are always ready to slaughter at about 6 to 8 weeks. So in the industry, how old are those chickens that we're eating in the grocery store? Are they younger mm-hmm. than that?
Wow. This is so outside my area of expertise. I'm actually thinking I wish I had your chickens because they sound delicious. But
they are. They're absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, I have a hunch it probably is sooner than that, but I honestly don't know. I'm sorry.
I think in the in industry, the issue is the huge numbers in very small places so that the risk of infection is increased. Is that fair to guess?
Well, I think there are two things here. There's one, being able to use that kind of farming style, that kind of animal production, and relying on antibiotics to prevent infection, amongst the flock. But I think there is also the very direct growth promotion aspect that gets them out of the facility sooner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was.
So do you think even sooner than 8 weeks, perhaps, or 6 weeks? Do you think even faster than that?
I can Google it for you.
No, that's okay. I can Google it.
We might get into this effect on the what's called the microbiome. It's fascinating to me is how antibiotics are found to increase growth and what's the mechanism there. So if we got a chance, maybe we'll ask whether the something called the microbiome effect is important here.
That'd be great. Well, thank you so much. This is absolutely fascinating, and I'm so glad that you took the time to present this program today.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Lisa, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, tell me if I'm repeating something. I wasn't able to catch the whole show, but I'm wondering about if there's any evidence linking antibiotic use to Crohn's disease, and if so, what can be done about that? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay, good. That's an important question. As we use antibiotics and they kill susceptible bacteria in our intestinal tract, does that have consequences? Is the generic question there, Dr. Bell?
Sure. Well, you know, to respond specifically to the question about Crohn's, I don't know of any direct relationship between antibiotic use and Crohn's disease. There have been, you know, thoughts about could there be certain organisms behind that, you know, leading to an immune response, that kind of thing. But I don't know of anything that's been shown directly linked to antibiotic use. For the more general question of how antibiotics change the population of bacteria that we carry, there's very clear evidence that antibiotics disrupt our normal bacterial populations. And these populations are much more complex than I think we ever really realized. The number of organisms that we can list that exist in a human gut is a fraction of the total number. There are thousands and thousands of bacteria that haven't even been identified or even grown that contribute to that normal balance. And so when we wipe out, half of that, we can be causing tremendous impact to that normal population. The most straightforward effect of that is what I mentioned with the Clostridium difficile, where if the normal inhabitants of that certain ecologic niche in your gut are wiped out, that opens up some space for other things to grow and start multiplying. It's kind of like when a large tree falls in the forest and, you know, suddenly there's sunlight streaming in and all these other things can start growing in the undergrowth. Similar to that, we see the population of the human gut shift very quickly when we wipe out something that's supposed to be there. But there's also a much more complex interaction between, as you say, the microbiome, that world of many different organisms living together in the gut. And it's not just the gut. There's also a biome on your skin and your nostril. You know, wherever organisms can live, they tend to create a complex community. And when we disrupt that, it is still not very clear what the secondary effects might be related to our ability to digest certain foods, or the type of metabolic hormones and signals that are released by our gut. The gut is actually much more than just an absorptive tube that takes in nutrients. It releases a wide range of chemical signals that adjust how the body works. And it's still really quite early, scientifically speaking, in our understanding of that complex system.
It's particularly becoming important to is recognized as where the initial exposure to our immune system to microbes occurs. And we always thought it was the skin and the respiratory tract, but the gastrointestinal tract seems to be a very, very important place as well, so that you could imagine that disturbing that system might have some consequences.
Absolutely.
The purpose of this program is to educate the public, and I'm always stuck between wanting to help somebody and stimulate some unnecessary or inappropriate moves. But when I hear people talk about Crohn's disease and antibiotics in the gut bacteria, it's a natural thing to wonder if food or infections may play a role. But I also feel it necessary to point out that there is some evidence that changing the microbial flora can rid us of some serious problems, such as Clostridium difficile infections that Dr. Bell mentioned, and Crohn's disease. And that's being done somewhat experimentally, but some very interesting results with Crohn's by fecal transplants, which may affect people's thoughts a little bit, but there is pretty good evidence on that. Now, what I'm trying to say here is that I'm not proposing anybody go out and do that, but to get better educated on it, particularly if you have very difficult to control Clostridium difficile infection and perhaps even Crohn's disease. Dr. Bell, please don't hesitate to say I'm stepping out of line, because I really want to make sure I'm not overstepping my bounds, but trying to be open people's understanding of where we are with this.
No, I think you're spot on. You know, the concept of a fecal transplant, it sounds nasty because, well, it kind of is. But the idea here is that of those thousands and thousands and thousands of bacteria that we don't even really identify at this point, you know, we're on the verge of having the science and technology to actually be able to find out what these organisms are and what they're doing. And so it's a very exciting time, and as we do that, we're able to go from sort of the old version, which was let's eat yogurt because it has lactobacillus and that's supposed to be in your gut. You can imagine how far that falls short when you're talking about repopulating with one organism, or maybe two or three, and in fact what you've done is lost thousands of different species. As we start to figure out what all of those species are, we'll probably be able to do a much better job of repopulating a healthy gut environment down the road. In the short term, the easy way to do this is not to worry so much about, you know, who all the players are, but just to take healthy stool and transplant it into someone who is suffering from something like severe Clostridium difficile. And that has actually succeeded. So I expect us to hear more about that. I can tell you that agencies like the Food and Drug Administration are currently struggling about how to classify that kind of treatment. Is it a transplant, or is it a pharmaceutical product, or is it a food? Kind of a challenging issue right now, but I think there's a tremendous amount of promise there.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating area. And it gets back to this immune system reaction, interacting with our intestinal microbes. Let me remind one more time, I want to remind our listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest is Dr. Michael Bell, and we're talking about antibiotic overuse and resistance to antibiotics by microbes. If you have questions or comments, we'll be with you for about another 15 minutes or so at 550-8433. That's where you can call and ask your questions or make comments, 550-8433. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Nicole, what can we do for you?
I'm a healthy 33-year-old female, and I am currently taking a antiviral for shingles. I've been very careful with antibiotic use. I've only taken it once in the past decade, but I don't know very much about possible overuse of antivirals or what kind of possible side effects down the road that has.
Great question. Dr. Bell?
Well, first and foremost, it's good that you're being treated, because effective treatment for shingles means you'll have less leftover pain, and that's a good thing. And I'm sorry you're dealing with that. That's miserable. In terms of antivirals, I think we can sort of take this up one notch just in terms of a higher level view, and say that with these medications, the further from human cells the target is, the better off we are. In other words, we can find chemicals that will disrupt part of a really what it boils down to is part of a chemical reaction that's necessary for another organism, but doesn't disrupt anything in a human. We can do that pretty well with bacteria because we're very different and we rely on different chemical reactions. With viruses, and just to extend that concept, as we move towards funguses and even protozoal parasites, like the malaria parasite, for example, we're getting closer and closer to mammals. And the chemical reactions are more and more likely to be shared, So that's one of the reasons why being treated for a bad parasitic infection can have a lot more toxic side effects, because those drugs are a little bit closer to what would affect our normal chemical processes. With viruses, these are little machines that basically hijack human cells, and so you're looking for ways that you can break up a chemical reaction that the virus needs to reproduce without doing something too bad to the human cells that they've hijacked. So as with everything, it depends on which antiviral you're on and so on. But, you know, it's something that is arguably a little bit easier than with something for a bacterium, and certainly for something like an antiparasitic.
But resistance to antivirals can occur, particularly we know that from HIV treatment.
Oh, absolutely. The resistance question is a different one. So as opposed to side effects in humans that are taking the medication, the viruses themselves, again, there's a variety, but if you think about something like the HIV virus causes so many accidental mutations. It's a very sloppy reproducer, and those mutations make it a slippery target. You might have an antiviral that works perfectly at first, but then as those mistakes accumulate, a couple of them end up basically removing the targeted chemical reaction, changing that target so that all of a sudden the antiviral doesn't work. That's one of the reasons why we use multiple drugs at the same time. The probability of a virus like HIV developing resistance to one drug is very, very high. The probability of it developing resistance to two different targets at the same time is a little lower, and we up the ante to three, and that makes it much more likely that the antivirals will continue to succeed.
That help, Nicole?
Absolutely. That's and the shingles are no fun, but I'm doing fine.
And consider if there's no reason not to get a shingles vaccine.
Yeah, even for a 33-year-old?
Well, there's a good question. I'm 65. I got one because it's recommended. Dr. Bell, you're a good one to ask. 33-year-old having shingles.
You know, it's tough to tell you exactly what to do over the phone, but I would definitely bring it up with your primary doc.
Yeah, there's no increased risk. The issue is how effective it would be.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Think about it.
Thank you very much. I will.
All right. Have a good day.
Take care.
All right. We have an email. Basically, he's enjoying the show. Says, can your guest address who's responsible governmentally for preventing misuse of antibiotics, especially in the agricultural setting?
So the agricultural world is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They're working very closely with the Food and Drug Administration that oversees, drug licensure and what drugs can be indicated for. So it's those two groups that are predominantly working with the agricultural industry to try to find, the reasonable happy medium. As we sort of commented on offline, we don't want to take away something valuable for the country. We want to maintain a safe and healthy food supply that people can afford, but at the same time, we don't want to be wasting antibiotics that we need for human health or veterinary health, and we don't want to be creating a huge population of resistant bacteria. So finding that happy medium is the work that they're engaged in right now.
Okay. Roger, you're on line one.
Hello there. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm an avid television watcher on nature and stuff, and I've seen elephants, the young elephants, eat the mother's dung to get the bacteria that belongs in their stomach. So that's a form of fecal implant. And that's been going on for eons.
A very direct form, yes.
Yeah, I guess I don't know enough about different animals have different ways of acquiring their natural immunity. I don't know enough about animals, and One of the problems in the human gastrointestinal tract is a lot of stuff that gets into the upper gastrointestinal tract does not survive to get down to where we think we want it. So, I hear what you're saying, Roger, and I guess the answer is we're still learning.
I know, and I'm glad we are. I'm glad we are. Appreciate you, both of you doctors, for what you're doing in the community.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Roger.
Yeah,
Sheila, what can we do for you?
Hi. I was given leflufloxacin for a sinus infection and had an enormous reaction in terms of achy muscles and joints for about 6 months. And I guess I'm kind of curious about some of the serious side effects that can occur around antibiotics that sometimes patients aren't aware of when they walk in.
Okie doke. Good question.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you bring it up because, you know, if there's one thing I would love folks to be thinking at the end of all of this, it's that, you know, I as a patient should ask, do I really need this drug? When people are, you know, thinking about prescribing antibiotics, if there's a clear indication, a clear need, then that's one thing. But I think rather than the very common sense of the common habit of saying, "I really want an antibiotic. I can't afford to be sick right now. I want an antibiotic." I would love to see that turned around to, you know, it's not pleasant having a cough, but do I really need this antibiotic? Will this go away without it? Because you're exactly right. There is a rare incidence of unexpected side effects or unusual side effects that still do happen, and you hate to be that one in a million. You know, the Food and Drug Administration requires a lot of proof that medications are safe before they're allowed to be marketed in this country. But at the same time, if something is a super rare event, the first several hundred people that you know are tested with this may not actually have that unlucky event. And it's not until after the fact that some things show up. So you can never be too careful. And I think that question of do I really need this is an important one to ask.
Hello?
Yep.
Well, I would say that's a really hard one to navigate because I think when you go in and you're sick
right.
and you are given an antibiotic by a physician, it's hard to, you know, I mean, I find it a hard question. I guess for me, from my experience, I finally figured out what was wrong. I was given the medication several times after complaining about the problem, and I ended up going online. And I guess what I would recommend to people is not only ask that question, but when you get the drug and bring it home, look it up. And then when you realize the possible potentials of it, maybe then ask that question to your doctor, because it's a hard one to navigate when you're in there and you're ill.
Right.
I think it's clear that, you know, if you had it to do over again, you probably, you know, are armed with another question to ask. But you're right. There's no easy way to have avoided that from your perspective. I'll also put in a plug for your pharmacist. You know, I happen to be lucky enough to have a very good pharmacist who gives me a great deal of information as a patient when I go in to fill a prescription. And that's another resource that you can use if you have concerns or questions about possible side effects.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Sheila, but the couple of times I've said on the program, I think it's always important because physicians should be thinking like this and patients as well, is what's the risk of doing any treatment and what's the risk of not treating? And you're balancing those risks. And then if you do have a side effect or you think you are, then touching base with the provider again is important because sometimes it is due to the medication, sometimes it's really not, and we get the wrong idea about what's really going on. So good luck with that in the future, though.
Thank you.
All righty. What is the one resistant organism that's developing resistance that keeps the CDC up at night?
Oh, I've got three or four, but I can share two of the top ones.
All right. Three.
I mentioned carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, the E. coli's that are becoming increasingly untreatable. We've now had a couple of them in this country that really are untreatable. And they can, you know, they live in your gut. You can't get rid of them. You shouldn't get rid of them. You're supposed to have E. coli. But if we end up having a lot of E. coli resistant to all possible treatments, that's going to change how we practice medicine in a very, very dramatic way. You know, example of this is I can't tell you how many times I've had somebody come in for a quick office visit for a urinary tract infection, and you do a couple of tests, write a prescription, and that person is back at work within an hour or two. If all of a sudden there's a reasonable chance that this is going to fail treatment because of that resistant E. coli, then you could be looking at a situation where any common urinary tract infection requires a hospital visit with, a temporary IV line and intravenous antibiotics, if you're lucky. We've seen situations where really there was no recourse, and it took us back to, the 1800s, where there's some hand-holding and some supportive measures that we can do, but without the ability to actually kill the bug that's circulating, for example, in the bloodstream where it shouldn't be, that really changes the state of medicine in this country. So there's that one. If that becomes commonplace, we're in deep trouble, and that's one of the reasons why CDC has made such a big push to raise awareness about antibiotic resistance. It's still rare. We've seen it in about 40-some states now, so it's widespread but uncommon. We want to make sure that it stays that way, and if we can stamp it out altogether, so much the better. Another one that worries me a great deal is untreatable tuberculosis. You've probably heard of XDR-TB. Fortunately, there's not a huge amount of tuberculosis in the United States right now, but international travel can deliver coughing individuals all around the planet, like we saw with SARS. And if untreatable tuberculosis takes root in a densely populated community, it can wreak havoc. We rely on anti-tuberculosis medications to treat this disease, but if we think back to the days when people died of consumption, it was a very large public health problem, and it can again change how we think about things like mass transportation, being in a crowded airport. If there's a circulating untreatable airborne infection, that becomes a very daunting proposition. The last one that I'll toss out there is being, I could go on and on. There's so many. Gonorrhea is becoming rapidly untreatable in many parts of the world. It's not a fun topic to talk about, but if that starts spreading in this country, then we've got a new and major problem, or actually an old and major problem. If we can no longer rely on anti-malarials, it means that travel to places that have malaria will become much more dangerous. Those are just a handful of the examples I can give you, but there are many of them.
All right. In the last 30 seconds or so, you want to kind of sum up and put this all in perspective for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So antibiotics are a national resource. They are, in fact, a precious resource that I think we've taken for granted for a long time. I think that we are on the verge of losing the capability of treating some very common infections that can be lethal. And in contrast to the past 80 or 90 years, when we've burned through antibiotics, there aren't any in the pipeline that we can point at. And so we've got to be careful with what we have so that they continue to work.
Thanks very much, Dr. Michael Bell, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure being with you.
Cultural diversity is increasing in the United States and in healthcare. And on our next program, we'll be discussing how cultural beliefs can affect healthcare with Dr. Benjamin Danielson of the University of Washington. He's also medical director of Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle. So why not tune into your health next Monday? Pat Yak is a chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and also our engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.